Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, taking you down the stairs of the human psyche into the basement of reality, where we will, once more, examine the psychological implications of violent crimes and the perpetrators who commit them. In this episode, we're taking a look at the gruesome, horrifying, and seemingly inexplicable hi-fi murders which occurred at the hi-fi shop in Ogden, Utah, on the evening of April 22, 1974, leaving three people dead, two others badly injured, and nearly $25,000 worth of audio and other electronic equipment missing from the premises. Shortly before closing time that evening, a small group of men arrived outside the shop, a group believed to have consisted of young airmen from a nearby Air Force base. However, while it's believed a number of men were involved in the robbery, at the culmination of this story, only three of the participants will be identified. Perhaps the closest estimate to what really happened here is that three or four men entered the store to carry out the robbery of the equipment, while two waited in the getaway vehicle, which had 20-year-old Keith Roberts behind the wheel. Now, of those three or four men who entered the store, it's believed that only two of them, Dale Selby Pierre, 21, and William Andrews, 19, are the people who were present during the torture and death to follow. Everybody else seems to have left by then, which means that the three men in question are the ones with serious psychological issues requiring an extended narrative beyond the robbery itself. Dale Selby Pierre is the ringleader of this crew in terms of being an enforcer, the guy with all the marbles loose in his head. He changed his name so many times over the years that you can find him listed as multiple different arrangements of the trio of the words Dale Selby Pierre. At one point prior to this incident, he was suspected, but not charged or convicted, of ramming a bayonet into a fellow serviceman's face so far that it not only killed him, but left the blade so deep that only the handle beyond it could be seen. Months prior to this incident, William Andrews allegedly told a fellow airman that he was going to rob the hi-fi store one day, and if anybody got in his way, he was going to kill them. Strangely enough, nobody gets in his way or tries to stop him, and William Andrews, at the culmination of this crime, though he was present for all of the violence, never actually committed any of it. It's Dale Selby Pierre who does it. Andrews is considered the guy to have set up the crime, the mastermind, so to speak. Now, if psychological implications are behind the motivation for the crime, then what we understand is that the thing they're stealing will be the manifested equivalent, or physical equivalent, of what's been taken from them emotionally, and will arrive in the form of resources designed to create balance. Basically, you took this from me emotionally, so to get even, I'm going to take it from you physically. And again, that logic works for the perpetrator in manifestation because our physical reality is a projection of our emotional world. That says the emotional wound precipitating this incident has become irreconcilable, and it is now going to spill out into physicality. Now, if these three men manifesting physical solutions for their emotional needs have failed to this point, we simply need to evaluate the nature of their prior failures to accommodate understanding of what gave the hi-fi shop specifically so much value in their eyes. Well, what position does each man hold? Airman in the Air Force. Here's a definition from military.com. Most airmen and airwomen work on flight support missions, handle base affairs, protect bases, construct new airstrips, guard missile sites, and even do rescues. Now, do you notice anything, any emotional correlation to the desire to ascend? For the most part, even though you're in the Air Force, ironically, airman is a grounded position. You don't take flight. The ground is the circle, while the straight line is taking flight upward. But like we talked about in the missed episodes, those who refuse to take flight, or ascend, or mature emotionally, indulge the horizontal straight line instead of the vertical one. So not surprisingly, what do we get when we see the instance of a bayonet being used to stab the brain? Extraction of the circle in favor of the straight line, which manifests the emotional change necessary to take flight. In the earliest endeavors to evolve across the Earth's surface, men left the circle of home along the straight line of the evolutionary pathway to acquire resources. Now, if we understand the emotional issue is remaining grounded while trying to move forward and not being able to ascend or escape our circumstances, let's ask ourselves which man in this trio of perpetrators is most literally, by way of physicality, going to remain grounded, even though moving forward, while trying to escape this crime. That would be the getaway driver. They all will, but he's at the wheel. So let's think about his intentions. The getaway driver, Keith Roberts, is manifesting the idea of getting away after a theft. So on an emotional level, he's here to take back what was taken from him, but in physicality, because the emotional component in the past is irreconcilable. The most commonly and emotionally irreconcilable thing for a person of this age, as it relates to the past, is suffering abuse at the hands of a parent, something that would spur the desire to take flight to escape that person or those people. But while you can run from the problems you face in society, there is definitely no way to escape the fallout emotionally inside your head. So if you were at this store preparing to rob it, the store itself, meaning what they sell, would have to accommodate the symbolic narrative of emotional necessity. Therefore, this place sells audio equipment, specifically electronic audio equipment, and does so under the guise of hi-fi, which in the 1970s spoke to what? Greater clarity. It promised you could hear the sounds or noises like never before, which is great if you're looking for a stereo. But if you're suffering because of the noises in your head or intrusions of realization coming up from the unconscious mind into the conscious mind, and in a place where they can be seen through the glass storefront of the subconscious mind, driving past that place physically and seeing it will manifest what? The desire to get that noise out of your head, to quiet the sounds and bring balance within. So if something in the storefront window says it costs $50, a person manifesting a jailbreak into sociopathy literally has a price tag for which they can create a physical value for an emotional entity. They can look at it and say, "This is how much has been taken from me." In return, that value becomes how much needs to be stolen, and from that exchange, you get manifested balance. Now, in order to get all the bad thoughts out of your head, you have to manifest the idea of getting all of the equipment out of the store. So they get $25,000 worth, and this is 1974, so that amount is likely the equivalent of more than $100,000 today. So, the audio equipment becomes symbolic of the realizations of your lack of transcendence, meaning the noises in your head, and they are, of course, like the brain in the head, housed in the store. That means the store becomes the manifested equivalent of each perpetrator's brain or mind, and going behind the storefront glass to steal the audio equates to going past the subconscious down into the unconscious mind to physically make those thoughts or voices unrealized again, something that is obviously impossible on a psychological level. All of which is to say, the theme here for the three main perpetrators is to steal or take everything that makes noise inside the store, because that equates to their heads. The only issue with that is you have two employees inside the store, and taking a life means something a whole lot different than taking a stereo. The stereo is simply turned off to accommodate silencing it. The human, however, has to be killed. Anyhow, moving forward, what we should see is the manifested idea of getting all the bad things out of your head by way of a big bang, but not in the sense of emotional rebirth, rather manifested physically through a gun or similar. Blowing the brains out with the disappearing straight line of the bullet manifests the idea of the singularity erupting at the point of the big bang, which is specifically a physical rebirth. However, in the universe, the Big Bang comes from peace, yet in this manifested narrative, it will be reversed in order to bring peace. So Dale Selby Pierre and William Andrews enter the hi-fi shop just before closing time. They encounter the only two employees working at the time, who are Stanley Walker, 20, and Michelle Ansley, who was about 18 or 19. The men pose as customers, but quickly turn the tables on the employees. Again, it's believed three or four men were involved in the actual robbery aspect, and the uncertainty involved in stating that as fact comes from knowing that both Stanley and Michelle are among those who die, meaning they could never offer a witness account of this part of the narrative. So, the audio equipment goes out the door, fulfilling the symbolic resonance of getting the bad thoughts that are making unwanted noise out of their heads, and creating manifested balance by exchanging them for physical resources like money in the absence of being able to find balance through the emotional growth of letting go and moving on. Now, they can make the unrealized thoughts in the form of the equipment disappear, which is the equivalent of taking them to the abyss and submerging them. But in this story, these guys have to take all of this equipment to a storage unit they rented, and doing it with two dead bodies in tow is a bad idea, which means the process by which they become submerged in the darkness of the abyss to become unrealized will happen in the basement. Now, when our emotional problems accost us by way of realization and we can't move forward, how do we feel? Stuck, right? Trapped, like we can't move. So, just like the horrors are on one side of the glass for the men entering the store, the same is true on the other side. The employees have the realization of these men entering past that barrier, tying them up, and making it impossible to escape the onslaught. Then the men will take them down to the basement, which is the equivalent of the abyss in which we are cleansed. That means cleansed of our bodies, or the manifested version of the ego, over time, and by way of emotional growth, leading to material innovation. So the cleansing essentially begins inside us, or emotionally, and then goes outside, physically. And here, quite unfortunately, that cleansing is going to be literal, meaning that the emotional purge of the things inside that hurt us, leading to rebirth, is going to be utilized here, yet in the reverse order, meaning the context of death. So Michelle and Stanley are taken to the basement and unable to escape. They're bound and gagged. They're stuck down in the darkness, silenced. If they call out for help, nobody will hear them. And that's the point. That's how we suffer emotional death. Deep down inside, in darkness, in the place it hurts most, and alone. Crying out from within that place means that no one will hear you. No one can see you. But you're there. And you desperately need help. That's the emotional life of the perpetrator. So to bring balance, it becomes the physical death of the victims. It's killing him inside his head, so he kills them outside it. Now, clearly, these dudes are reversing our evolutionary narrative, taking the equivalent of the woman, or mother, meaning the circle in the form of Michelle, along with her binary counterpart of the straight line, or man, or son, meaning Jesus, in the form of Stanley, back downstairs, aka back down the evolutionary ladder, toward the beginning, or basement, when there was only darkness in the universe. Now, why am I assuming Stanley is the son? Well, it's structural. If you take the evolutionary narrative back to the beginning, Jesus descends from earth, followed by God from heaven. So we already know the Father is going to show up, meaning Stanley's father. And what else we already know is that those ones, or straight lines, of Father and Son are going to become redundant, like Jesus and God, by way of the same process as Jesus giving way to the Father, God. So, in this reversed narrative to accommodate death instead of rebirth or life, by way of structural necessity, Stanley will be cleansed like Jesus, and the Big Bang or gunshot will return us to darkness or death, leaving only the singularity or Father back at the beginning. So, of course, through structural necessity, Stanley, playing Jesus, dies, and his father lives. But for now, with Stanley and Michelle bound and gagged in the basement, and Pierre and Andrews both armed with .25 caliber and .38 caliber handguns, 16-year-old Courtney Nesbitt pops his head into the store to show his appreciation for Stanley letting him park in the shop's lot while he ran an errand nearby. The men escort Courtney down to the basement as well, where he's bound and gagged. Now, as we know, the Father and the Son are supposed to merge at the intersection of the seeker and the sought, meaning Jesus finding his way home to God, or the junction at the center of the infinite loop, or even the convergence of the X and Y axis on the coordinate plane. But Stanley, or Jesus, never arrives home to merge with his Father because this narrative is going in reverse, remember? So instead of Stanley, or Jesus, being the seeker and coming home to Dad, or God, or in Walker, Stanley's father will go looking for him instead, which means he's going back to the beginning of the evolutionary narrative. He's going to descend instead of ascend, meaning he's going to end up going down into the basement. So basically, the Father, or God, will descend from above, meaning heaven, down into darkness instead of rising from it, joining Jesus, or Stanley, but in the form of the singularity, or one, making Stanley redundant as the other one, or, in this case, dead. They are the two redundant ones that become a single one, or singularity, at both the beginning and the end, leaving only the Father. So now that we've addressed the straight lines, let's look at the circles. Michelle Ansley is barely an adult and not a mother, so to pair her with 16-year-old Courtney as the mother-child or mother-son relationship is inaccurate because, quite simply, Michelle is only 2 or 3 years older. She couldn't be mom. Mother and son, in the form of a boy, equate to the circle because traditionally in our evolution, women and children stayed back at the village while the men went out on the straight line of the hunt. So we not only need a woman who can serve as Courtney's mother to show up now, but we understand that the structure dictates that Courtney and his mother, or whoever's playing his mother here, will die first. Jesus and God are the beginning and end, one and the same essentially, so extraction of mother and son, or child, meaning the circle, happens between in our evolution, dictating that mother and son, or boy, representing the womb, are extracted before father and son, in this case, son, meaning man, like Jesus was in the flesh, rather than son coming from a womb. Accordingly, it means the best fit here is Courtney's mother, as he comes from her womb, literally, and for the same reason as Stanley's father. Courtney never arrives home to meet her. If this was an evolutionary rather than regressive narrative, meaning one progressing forward instead of backward, Courtney would arrive home first, followed by Stanley. But reversing it gives us Oren arriving at the store first, followed by Courtney's mom. And like I said, that evolutionary narrative should have happened. That's what was intended originally. Courtney popped in when the store was still open and when he was going to head home from his errand. Stanley was still working, but would have arrived soon afterward when the store closed. Anyhow, Courtney's mother now is taken down to the basement too, as a hostage, bound and gagged. So now they're in the abyss, all five of these hostages, the place of change. But the scary part is that it's a manifestation of the emotional growth these perpetrators refuse to undergo. So instead of making emotional sacrifices or changes to themselves to embrace rebirth now that they're down here, they'll sacrifice others by making physical changes to them, resulting in death. Now, notice what's true now that they're in the basement. All of the audio equipment above is gone, symbolically fulfilling the idea of all the noises in their heads being taken away. But where do those noises, those realizations, come from? The basement of our emotional world, the abyss or unconscious mind. Everything rises from there into the light. So to submerge it there and kill it is the ideal, as that process manifests the idea of making those terrible realizations unrealized again. Ignorance is bliss, right, when it comes to emotional pain. Now, as we evolve, the red giant of conservatism must always be cooled by the blue wave of progress to follow. Red-shifted light colliding with blue-shifted light over time cleanses us of the ego or the things that are wrong with us inside that spill out into our physical world as toxicity. That process renders a cleansing or purging of ego, culminating in those blue and red sides by way of the Doppler effect producing white light, and even more specifically, ascending white light. In effect, that constitutes a merging of the color scale. So here, the cleansing we should expect to see will manifest the physical idea of keeping the things that hurt inside. And of course, the regression means the blue wave of cooling will come first, making it ironic, and therefore, from a structural standpoint, it means this tragic event will provide heating instead. There will be no emotional progress, so in this event of regression, the blue wave will simply be disguised as such, but really just be an extension of the red giant, telling us that there will be no cooling at all. Now, we need to represent the dark waters of the unconscious mind being consumed physically in order to reverse the idea of it consuming the perpetrator emotionally. That brings balance in his mind. So Dale Selby Pierre, a few weeks earlier, had seen a movie called Magnum Force, in which a man is killed instantly by drinking Drano, the drain cleaner, leaving him to bring it with him this time. Now, like we said, the blue wave in the form of the blue liquid Drano is really a red giant in disguise, but again is being posed as the blue wave, which means by way of structural necessity, Pierre will lie to them about what it is, specifically in the context of being something that will prevent them from feeling any emotional pain, as opposed to something that will cause them to feel the extent of physical pain. So he fills this cup with a Drano bottle that's hidden in a brown paper bag and tries to give it to Orin Walker first so that Orin can force the group to drink it. That gives us strong insight into the emotional wound of Dale Selby Pierre, meaning whatever happened in his past that has caused this. The first person he orders to hurt everyone else physically is the father. Yet Pierre is giving the orders in the role of the father, which makes Orin the son, telling us that Pierre's father, or a father figure, is the one who hurt him or abused him emotionally as a kid, and likely physically as well, but leaving these emotional scars. That's the person who poisoned his mind, so now he's going to ironically cleanse their bodies with poison physically to compensate. It's revenge fantasy. Somebody poisoned his mind emotionally, so he poisons their bodies physically in order to bring balance. Orin is the only middle-aged man there, the only one old enough to be Pierre's father, even if only symbolically, so he's projecting Orin into that role. This is a transcendence issue. Pierre has some type of emotional wound related to his father in the past, most likely abuse, that has kept him from feeling like he can take flight, which manifests as being a grounded airman in the Air Force. If he can't ascend emotionally and dies an emotional death getting up the hill to adulthood, then the father has to be taken back down that hill to that place where he died emotionally and be killed physically to bring balance. But in the same way Pierre obviously couldn't overcome the emotional damage to become the father, or kill the father symbolically, so to speak, that narrative will remain physically with his attempts to try to kill Orin Walker. No matter what Pierre does to Orin physically, no matter how brutal it gets, the father never dies because that's what was going on in Pierre's mind emotionally. He couldn't let go of the past. It was irreconcilable. So he decided to project that perpetual suffering onto a physical canvas and kill it. Clearly, in the past, Pierre's father was the one who poisoned his family emotionally, so to speak, and did it against their will. So in the basement, Orin is being forced to play the role of the father to this makeshift family and impose that punishment against his will. And the point is that, once he does, he will literally have poisoned and killed the family, leaving him to be crushed by the tragedy of what he had done. Pierre wants to see that play out in physicality. He wants to see the remorse of the father for his wrongdoing, something he never got to feel as a kid. He wants to see the tears that obviously never came for his suffering. And then once he sees the father crying and begging for his own life, he'll make the man feel what he had done to everyone else, which is poison him and kill him physically to match the emotional toll. It brings balance. But there's a bit of a problem. The irony present is that Orin is a good guy, meaning a good father to his son, a person who showed up because he thought his son was in danger. He isn't the type of guy to poison his son, or anybody else for that matter. In fact, this integrity makes him the kind of man who just says, "No, I won't hurt them." And that absolutely enrages Pierre because it's showing Pierre the man he needs to be. Despite what we have suffered, we must find the strength to not hurt others due to that. Letting go of the pain from the past, cleansing yourself of ego, is difficult for that reason. There is no shortcut to finding balance. So Pierre forces everybody to drink the Drano at gunpoint and takes it to Orin last. By this time, everybody is yelling and screaming in agony due to the burns on their lips and in their mouths, leading down through the esophagus into the stomach. People are coughing and convulsing, and the Drano is coming back up instead of staying down. Now, the cleansing or purging of the ego from within leads to the white light rising, but in this case, it becomes white foam, which spews out of the mouths of the victims. So think of that. The blue Drano and resulting massive inflammation of the resulting red giant still cause the white light to rise, but embodied in physicality as foam. Now, if that happens, it also means the bookends of the color scale have converged. To manifest that idea of white and black merging, which makes gray, after giving them the Drano and seeing the white foam rise, Pierre, a black man, puts duct tape over the mouths of the white victims. But what do we know about our emotional problems? They leave us stuck because we refuse to rise above them. So here, as the white light rises in the form of the foam, signifying progress or change, what won't the duct tape do? Stick. Pierre can't get it to stick to their mouths to keep in the Drano. He's trying to keep the things that hurt them inside, like happened to him emotionally. Now at this point, he gives the Drano to Orin, but after seeing everyone else drink it, what do we know? Again, by way of structural necessity, as the father, he's going to do. It's all structural. He refuses the cleansing. God doesn't get cleansed in the process of evolution, and he's playing the role of the father. God is the thing that you reach at the culmination of the cleansing. So again, by way of structural necessity, Orin will not drink that shit. So when Pierre pours the Drano in, Orin spits it out. In our evolutionary narrative, again, the father dishes out the suffering of the cleansing by way of the Jesus character, meaning father implores son to do the cleansing, which is why Pierre wanted to stand over Orin, the father, essentially switching or reversing places so that Pierre could be the father forcing the son to induce the suffering. And in a minute here, you're going to hear more about his inability to kill the father, or transcend. That's his greatest goal. That is what's killing him inside. Now, like it happens in our evolutionary narrative, the cleansing is supposed to be a purification process. But when physically manifested, it becomes a poisoning. So rather than the purification of humanity's suffering, as depicted on the crucifix for the purpose of rebirth, here we get the agonizing cries of the victims being poisoned in the context of death. Now, what was Pierre's emotional problem, quite obviously? He couldn't grow up emotionally to transcend the father, which says he couldn't endure the emotional suffering of the journey through the abyss to get there. So likewise, in this situation, what is going to manifest? When these people begin to suffer horribly, instead of just dying like the man in Magnum Force, guess who can't deal with being immersed in this change? Dale Selby Pierre. Of course, what do we know he wants to do? He wants to silence the voices or noises or suffering in his head, that which is related to the past growing up in his family, as symbolized here with these people sufficing as a surrogate family. He's projecting them onto his own. He wants to cleanse them and silence them physically, meaning he wants to cleanse his mind of them and the associated suffering emotionally. He wants those voices from the past to quiet, the noise to stop. And here, these people are all crying out in agony from having consumed the Drano, so we know what's coming. Now, to become the father, you have to extract the circle, or mother and son, and make the two straight lines redundant in the way Jesus transcends to become God. So again, you go from one as the singularity to 1-0 in the binary universe of man-woman, and then back to 1-1, making a redundant set of ones that become one. So in our evolutionary narrative, the first aspect to die, so to speak, or transform, is the zero, or circle, meaning mother and son, which are extracted. So what he needs to do here, meaning Pierre, is use a big bang to kill Courtney and Carol, mother and son, first. He does that. Pierre shoots them both in the back of the head. But wait, what do we know is his emotional wound? He's still living in the past, aka back at the circle, in his childhood home life. So when he shoots mother and son here, guess which one doesn't die? The son, Courtney. It's nature telling Pierre that he can't kill the son or himself physically to become the father. It's an emotional endeavor. Now, because he doesn't realize that emotionally, or refuses to look inside himself to see the truth, by way of structural necessity, he'll do the same in the context of Courtney physically. So in the same way the son still lives inside Pierre emotionally in his ignorance, or denial, meaning that he doesn't realize that he has to kill that thing emotionally, Courtney, as a projection of Pierre's childhood, does the same on the exterior, physically. He's alive, and Pierre doesn't realize it. He doesn't realize that Courtney still needs to be killed. And by the end, he never comes to realize it. Courtney survives. And that's the same thing going on with the child in his head. So the attempt to extract the circle ensues, and then we know he's going for the straight line. Now, the two crossing straight lines have to become redundant, leaving only the father and killing the son. So Pierre fires at the back of Oren's head and misses him for the same reason he couldn't kill the boy, Courtney. His target, aka his goal, is to leave behind the boy he was emotionally to become the father through transcendence. But that can't happen physically, leaving him symbolically and literally unable to kill both the boy projected as him, Courtney, and the father projected as his father, Oren. So after shooting Stanley and killing him, Pierre realizes he didn't actually hit Oren. So he fires at Oren again, but the bullet only grazes the man's head. For some reason, he has no problem hitting anyone else, but he can't manage to kill the father. So Pierre gets really upset at his failure to kill the father, and of course, we know what he's going to manifest now, all John Wayne Gacy style. You can see that his inability to kill the father is going to make him feel like what? Like his father is still in control, right? So he's going to lean on a greater means of control. That inability to kill the father physically matches his inability to kill the father emotionally in his head. No matter what he does, he can't seem to do it. So if his father has this much control over him, and it's strangling him, making him feel like he can't get breathing room from it emotionally, what is he going to do to the person he's projecting that father upon? Well, Pierre finds a wire and twists it into a garrote he uses to strangle Oren Walker. Yet, this man simply will not die. So if you have tried and failed to overcome this issue emotionally, and then this dude won't die physically, what does it say that you were unable to accomplish here? You were unable to make things right inside your head, specifically with the father. Therefore, to manifest that idea in the simplest, most gruesome terms necessary to convey his suffering as it occurs to him, Dale Pierre Selby gets a ballpoint pen, something guaranteed to make things right, and that comes in the form of a straight line, and he stomps it through Oren's ear canal with the intention of connecting the straight line of the pen to the circle of the brain and extracting the brain, manifesting the idea of killing the necessity of emotional change to transcend, which is exactly what is stopping him. To prove symbolically that this method will not bring unity between body and mind by killing the necessity for emotional change, the pen snaps in two instead, leaving one end in the head and the other in the neck. Oren Walker lives. You can't kill the father or brain or singularity. You have to transcend to becoming it. So notice that that pen snaps in half to say you have not satisfied your emotional disunity. This is only physicality. Now, due to that deficiency of not becoming the father by killing Oren, along with the father living in his head from the past, Pierre stoops to something even more pathetic to get it done, at least on a symbolic level. He rapes Michelle Ansley and has William Andrews watch. Of course, there's a different version of the story in which he sends Andrews outside, but I did not find that one believable. I do think that this is how it happened, and this is how the story more often occurs. So anyhow, he rapes Michelle Ansley and has William Andrews watch. Now, why would he do that? Well, if Pierre is the one participating in the act of creation with Michelle, and William Andrews is excluded, then what Andrews is suffering, even if only in Pierre's mind symbolically, is the inability to become the father, and specifically because he, meaning Pierre, is the one in control. Furthermore, why is that important? Well, the father has to rise from the abyss transformed. So Pierre, on a symbolic level, can't walk up the stairs into the light until he becomes the father in some way. Knowing that when he leaves, it will be him and William Andrews both going up the stairs, he needs to make it clear which one of them is father and which is son. When Christ rises from the womb reborn, he is both father and son. Same here, but since there is no merger leading to disembodiment, like Christ and God becoming the Holy Spirit and making those two redundant ones a single one, due to this physical reversal or regression, rather than what we see with emotional ascension or evolution, both men remain embodied in addition to being separate entities, having not merged, only symbolically fulfilling the necessity of father and son, and doing so by walking up the stairs from darkness into light. Orrin Walker, pretending to be dead, claims that Michelle Ansley begged incessantly for her life, but after she was raped, Pierre shot her in the back of the head. In fact, the last thing that Orrin says Michelle claimed was, "I'm too young to die." So let's look at that now. We know Carol, who was actually a middle-aged mother, played the role of the mother in this narrative and died. So why is Michelle now assuming her place? Well, in the infinite loop, the mother, or circle, is extracted from the middle, or more specifically, transformed into a straight line. But once the universe starts again with a big bang, she of course returns, and is obviously much younger, so to speak. One side of the binary universal chamber impregnates the other, if you will, with a big bang. So here, as we're going in reverse and intending death instead of rebirth, Pierre is going to rape and inseminate Michelle before giving her a big bang to the back of the head. The big bang is basically a massive orgasm that inseminates the universal womb with creation, or the life to come. So here, in this case, the intended usage is ironic, as it's a manifested tragedy, meaning that there isn't rebirth to follow, only death. And within that, we see the blame being placed upon the mother for bringing him into this world of suffering. He impregnates the mother with death in the context of being the father, so that the son will no longer be created and therefore won't suffer. And again, despite his best efforts and in his ignorance, he could not kill the boy, Courtney, nor could he overcome the man or father, Orrin Walker. And if we look at him trying and failing to transcend Orrin while being ignorant of the fact that Courtney was still alive, it tells us everything we need to know about his emotional inability to kill the boy living inside him in favor of becoming his own man. Courtney was injured, silenced, and stuck there, hoping for a miracle to escape, desperate for someone to come find him inside this place and save him. And it happened like that, because the store became the equivalent of Dale Pierre Selby's mind. It's obvious that, to a lesser extent, both William Andrews and getaway driver Keith Roberts came from the same type of a place, emotionally, and wanted to get out. Watch nature give them a big middle finger to teach the lesson. Now, what happens to bad things, or traumatic things that happen to you in your youth, meaning in the aftermath of them? Well, they get stored inside your head as memories, of course. and the emotional weight of not being able to hide that truth becomes too much to bear over time, and the secret gets out. So here, the audio equipment, symbolic of the noises in their heads, or bad thoughts, gets removed from the store. But since it's a manifested physical narrative, they're just going to go right back into another physical equivalent, meaning a cycle. So we learn that the men rented a storage unit earlier that day. They take all their audio equipment, or bad memories, and put it into a storage unit, symbolizing the fact that this is not emotional movement leading to change. Those items or problems go right back into storage because it represents a brain. So what they wanted more than anything in the world was for people to see the things inside their heads that hurt them. But since they manifested this narrative, what happens is that nature allows them what they want in the form of the cops showing up at the storage unit and seeing those things, leading to their arrest and ultimate execution or imprisonment. Now, subconsciously, because people are experiencing these things and are afraid to talk about them emotionally, what they do many times is commit crimes that manifest them physically so that the truth can finally be revealed. So where do you think detectives are going to learn the truth? When they arrive at the storage unit and find the audio equipment, which then will get physically moved again and put right back in the place from which it came. It's a cycle. There's never any emotional movement, so there's never any emotional change, which means physical manifestation of such, leading to violent crime, takes the place the person is stuck inside their head to an ironic sense of balance by giving them a prison cell to match. If you can't move emotionally and want to compensate with physicality, the place where you're stuck emotionally becomes a physical problem too. The universe manifests ironic, tragic balance to counteract your sociopathy. Now, while there was never any question about the extreme violence on display in this crime being worthy of capital punishment, there was the question of the validity of putting this matter of three black men on trial for their lives in front of an all-white jury in Utah. However, in the end, there was no question as to the guilt of these men. Pierre was so disturbed, in fact, that he kept the Drano bottle after the murders because there was still cleanser in it, which the cops found. A few hours after the murders, people rummaging through a nearby dumpster found a number of items that belonged to the victims and called the police. When the police searched the dumpster, they noticed two men acting strangely nearby, specifically like they were anxious and angry. After detaining the men, it was learned they were Pierre and Andrews. The cops subsequently discovered the storage unit, and Keith Roberts was identified as the driver. To this day, the other men who were potentially involved in the robbery aspect are considered to also have been airmen, but their identities, at least officially, remain unknown. Roberts received nearly 13 years in prison, while Pierre and Andrews were sentenced to death. Pierre was executed first, but it wasn't until Andrews met his fate that the truth about why this crime happened finally came to the surface in its simplest form. In the aftermath of the execution of Pierre, and less than a week after the subsequent execution of William Andrews, Keith Roberts, who had already served his time in prison and been released, put a gun to his head and pulled the trigger. He could never get the bad things out of his head. It's obvious that none of the perpetrators of the Hi-Fi murders could find the peace they sought in life, and instead found it only in death. But because of that, their victims suffered the same fate. Like Dale Pierre Selby stomping that ballpoint pen into Oren's ear, through stark, profound violence in order to tell his truth with such force that he'd finally be heard. They could never manage to make things right. They never managed to tell their story as it needed to be revealed. They never managed to make others understand what they felt inside their heads, because nobody could hear them. That's the pain they needed everyone to feel so badly. Yet they didn't realize that those people were already hurting too, because we're all on the other side of that glass, trapped in silence. We can't be seen or realized for what we really are. They only know what they see when they look, and that doesn't tell the story at all. At least, not about what we lost. And when the cost of what's been stolen prevents us from becoming what we need to be, sadly, we often decide to become what hurt us instead. So in the end, I think the frightening reality we face as vulnerable humans is that there really are no good guys and bad guys, just two sides of the same glass preparing to shatter, and the monster staring back at us, trying desperately to break through.